ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
50 years ago, on the 11th of November, a political earthquake erupted.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
It's the most famous chapter in our political history, and the fallout is still with us today. Hear the whole gripping story of the dismissal, unfolded scene by shocking scene, in our award-winning podcast, The 11th.
He looked at me and said, I owe history nothing.
Search for The 11th on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National, filling in for Beverly Wang this morning. It's not quite late enough in the year for you to take your foot off the pedal at work, but it's definitely late enough for you to really feel the 11 months we've white-knuckled it through so far. Hopefully you've got a break shimmering ahead of you on the horizon over Christmas and New Year. And maybe you're quietly hoping that over the holiday, the negative feelings you're currently harbouring about your job will be washed away and you'll return to the office with renewed vigour for 2026. But is it really that simple? Or are these kinds of feelings, like red flags in any relationship, a sign of something more serious? Today, let's explore the changes you can make in both the work and life space so that you feel re-energized in both of these domains. Then, in the next 40 minutes, it's time to Ask Auntie, tackling the case of double trouble with couple friends. What changes have you made to how you work that have helped you love your job? Maybe you've changed some simple habits, you've built new friendships at work, or you've made time for new friendships and interests outside of work. Or maybe you've completely ditched one career and found a new one. My guest today is not only an expert in changing how you work to better fit your job, but also changing your job to better fit your life. She says identifying what lights you up at work and outside of work can create a work life that feels manageable and meaningful and potentially rekindle the spark you and your job once shared. Dr. Michelle McQuid is a workplace researcher, a senior fellow at Melbourne University's Centre for Wellbeing Science, and an author whose latest book is Your Wellbeing Blueprint, Feeling Good and Doing Well at Work. Michelle, welcome to Life Matters.
Hey, Tegan, lovely to be with you.
I would love to know, Michelle, from your own perspective, what you've done to make your work life a better balance.
Yeah, well, really three things that I think we can all benefit from. The first is to think about good people that I get to work with. Am I surrounded by people at work, at least one of them, who I look forward to going and spending time with while I'm getting the job done? I think the second thing is, am I getting to do some good things? Doesn't have to be all day, every day, but in the what and the how I'm doing at work each day, does it feel like some of that, as you were saying in the introduction, lights me up? And the third is any of it having a good impact? And that doesn't mean I have to be saving the world, but it does mean that it needs to feel like it's meaningful in some way for me. So they're the three levers I guess I'm looking at to keep that spark around my work consistently.
And is that more about you and your attitude towards, you know, the people that you work with or the work that you do? Or is it more about going, choosing the job to yield those things?
Yeah, there's definitely an and to that. Sometimes we have the privilege of really being able to choose jobs that nail all those three things: good people, good things, good impact. But that's not always the case, or situations change and suddenly we've got different boss or parts of our job have been removed. It's like, oh, it doesn't feel that same way anymore. And so then it comes down to what's in our control. And the good news is there's far more actually in our control around these things than we often think. It's just learning how to play with the people a bit more.
It doesn't feel like that sometimes, especially I think when people are feeling really squeezed with cost of living. Can you like remind me what we do have agency over?
Yeah. So if we come back to those three pieces, the good people, yep, even if we're looking around our workplace going, oh, Michelle, I don't know where that good person is that I look forward to coming to work and spending time for, we need to keep looking. The research is really clear that having someone at work that we feel like we can have some sense of connection to really matters. And so it might be talking to people that we don't normally talk to, or opening up a bit more general conversation with people rather than just the task, so we can get to know them better. When it comes to good things, knowing what our strengths are, those things we're good at and enjoy doing, can help us turn some of those tedious to-dos into ta-das, as I like to think about them, by working with the bits of our brain that light up. We can talk more about that in a moment if you like. And having that good impact can just be getting clear about, well, why is my job meaningful to me? Is it just a job? It's a way to earn a paycheck so I can live and support myself and the people I care about? Is it more of a career? It's a stepping stone. This is taking me somewhere else, even if it's not great right now. Or can I find that positive difference my work makes to others each day?
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor, talking to Dr. Michelle McQuid, who's a workplace researcher and an author. And she's all here today to tell us how to turn our work to-dos into ta-das. And I couldn't be more delighted. Michelle, you're talking about your brain lighting up. This is sort of, it's not just a, well, it's not literally lighting up, but it's something that we can see in brain scans. It's literally based in neuroscience.
That's right. So our brain constantly, as we navigate each day, is trying to keep us alive. And it does that by figuring out, am I safe enough or not safe enough in this situation? So when work's lighting us up, the brain's going, oh, this feels safe enough. And all the blood and oxygen is going up to the front parts of our brain, where the forehead is. This is our prefrontal cortex, where all our best work happens. And you're right, Tegan, if I put you into an MRI machine, we would literally see neural pathways in your brain with that energy kind of flowing through them. But when the brain feels not safe enough, it feels like, I don't know if I can trust that colleague. I really don't know if I can do this task, or I'm dreading doing this task, or I don't feel like my work makes any difference to anybody. Then what we see instead is the blood and oxygen is more likely to move out towards our hands and our feet, and it's triggering more of those stress responses for us. And a little bit of that's not a problem, but too much for too long is really not great for our well-being.
That's crazy. I can't. Your blood shouldn't be in your hands if you're trying to use your brain to work.
It makes it difficult, Tegan.
I'm thinking about what you said about working with awesome people, and I feel very lucky. As you were describing that, I was like, yes, I am excited to work with my team each day. They're a magic bunch of people. For people who are working more at home, more remotely, has that made it harder to develop those relationships that really get you excited about logging on?
Yeah, we see this a lot in some of the mixed findings about the benefits of working from home or even hybrid work. We are wired to be social creatures. And so when we're missing more of those casual kind of water cooler, over the kettle interactions with each other, where we get to talk about what did we do on the weekend or what are we looking forward to that's coming up, we really do suffer on that relationship front. And so if we are working at home regularly, trying to think about how do we create some of those more casual connection opportunities, maybe before a meeting starts or towards the end of a meeting. I have a virtual team all over Australia, and so we do a lunch once a week virtually with each other, and it's whoever's around, but I'm there as the leader of the team, and you can come and have lunch and a bite, and we don't talk work, we just catch up with what's happening in each other's world.
One of the teams that I'm part of has a Slack channel because we're all over Australia. And on a Monday, we post pictures of our pets. And it is honestly such a lovely uplift on a Monday. So it is possible to do it remotely.
Yeah, I love that. And again, all sorts of things we've seen teams do. And inviting people, like taking your background off so people can see, actually, this is my home and this is where I am.
This is my washing on the line behind me.
Exactly. To let people see the perfectly imperfect people we all are actually gives us something to hold on to with each other.
So you've written that a positive work relationship is one that you call harmonious versus one that you call obsessive. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so this is the research of Dr. Robert Vallerand, and he found that although having a sense of meaning and purpose in our work can bring lots of well-being benefits for us, we can have too much of a good thing. And so he differentiates this idea that when our sense of meaning and connection to our work is harmonious, we feel in control of it. So we love what we're doing while we're at work, mostly, but we're also able to switch off. So we might still have things on the to-do list, but we're not lying awake in bed at night worrying about them. We know tomorrow's another day. We'll prioritise what needs to get done. We have more than our work when it comes to our sense of self and how we would identify ourselves. So I think about if you're out with somewhere and someone asks you, you know, what do you do? What do you enjoy? Is it all just about work or have you got other things that you can say there? And then the last one is we have healthy spaces for rest and recovery. So we realise we're not machines. We do need time out. The flip side of an obsessive passion for our work is really the opposite of that. The job is in control of us. We're constantly running to a never-ending to-do list. We feel like we can't stop and take rest and recovery breaks. And that feeling at work, being at work, feels so energising and gives us such a sense of purpose. It feels really hard for us to switch off from it.
That feels like something that I have a bit of control over, but not a lot of control over if my team is under-resourced or if I'm just in a job that's incredibly demanding. That ability to step back at the end of the day and say, okay, I can put this to one side until tomorrow, it seems to depend a lot on the job as well as on my attitude.
Yeah, again, I'm going to come to a yes and here, Tegan. It definitely can. And look, short bursts of that obsessive passion, I'm sort of putting in some extra hours and we're trying to get something done because we're on deadline or there's a big project, that in and of itself isn't such an issue. The challenge becomes when that's the norm every day. And so absolutely, I mean, our workplaces now have legal responsibilities to be trying to ensure that the demands of our jobs are matched with the resources that we have to get it done. This is the psychosocial legislation that's come in across Australia recently. But also we do find that if your sense of self-worth is so defined by your job, I think about one of my son's school teachers and we were at parent teacher and she was so sick she hardly had any voice left, Teague, unless she was croaking out. And I said to her, because I was doing wellbeing work with them at the school, and I said, I really think you should go home. All of the parents will understand. This can be rescheduled. There are other ways we can deal with this. And she was like, I can't let their kids down. And I was like, I get that. And you need to go home. And so sometimes our sense of worth is so tied to the job, the value of who we are, that we are actually adding to the problem of being able to switch off, even when our workplace is doing the best it can to manage those demands.
And it sets an example for your colleagues as well. Like it creates a culture where knowing your limits is okay.
Absolutely. It's a healthy boundary to have. And it's hard to continue to give and give in our jobs if we're out of energy. If there's nothing left to give, we kind of hit the bottom of the well and that's where we end up quietly cracking or burning out.
I do want to come to those ideas of quiet cracking and burning out. You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm with Dr. Michelle McQuid, who's just dropping so many facts about how to regain some agency and really fall in love with the work that you do and maybe reshape the work that you do to make it more lovable. Caroline, you did something with your home life that made your work life really different.
Yes. Good morning, Tegan. It's great to talk to you this morning.
Tell me what you did.
Yeah. I was for several years working across the city. I live in Sydney. And so this involved crossing the tunnel twice a day. And I have a daughter in primary school, which no doubt, as you might imagine, when I was stuck in the tunnel and there was a incident in there and I'm calling the other parents, can you pick up my daughter? So it was very, very stressful, causing a lot of anxiety to live so far away. As you know, people were saying before as well, I feel like, you know, letting people down because I have to leave early, extra early to go do this early commute and so forth. And then, you know, this year in January, decided let's move. We couldn't afford as big a place near my work, but we got a smaller place. So we have smaller living place, but wow, that hasn't made a difference. The school is 8 minutes from my work. I live 10 minutes from work. And it's amazing the hours I've regained and the joy.
That sounds really nice, Caroline, to be so close to everything. But it involved a compromise, like you've got a smaller place. Were you worried that it was the wrong choice before you made it?
Yeah, absolutely. And even the adjustment of pulling my daughter to a completely different school in an area that we didn't really know that well. Yeah, absolutely. But it turned out to be one of the best things we've done. Yeah.
I'm so happy to hear that. Caroline, thank you so much for the call. Michelle, this idea of really reshaping your life, it's a risk, but at least in Caroline's case, it had a big reward.
Yeah, well, I love, again, Carolyn's looking at what's in her control rather than just feeling stuck and continuing to leak energy in a situation that was really hard for it to be sustainable. One of the other interesting pieces of the research we see is that long commutes are one of the things that undermine our well-being most. And while we adapt to quite a lot of things in our life, that long commute, studies suggest, is one of the things never seems to get better for our well-being. So, again, there'll be a lot of science to support Caroline's choice that this was a big cost and the trade-off might be quite significant for her if she was able to make that shift.
I really like that language you used there about leaking energy, and it really comes to this idea of cracking and burnout that you spoke about before. Talk to me about this sort of pipeline of burnout.
Yeah, so we've just in July researched with more than 1,000 Australian workers to see how is everybody doing. I think 2025 for most of us has felt like a lot. And as you were saying, Tegan, we're white-knuckling our way to the end of the year. And what those workers told us is that 1 in 2 felt like they were quietly cracking. And we asked them, like, well, what do you mean by quietly cracking? And they said, I'm trying so hard on the outside to hold it all together at work, but I'm hiding that on the inside, I'm falling apart. And what we found was not only was quiet cracking not great for our well-being, but it made it 6 times more likely we would wind up clinically burnt out.
That idea of masking at work, I'm thinking about like, you know, when your kids are really little and they go to school and then they come home and they fall apart.
Yes,
and it's almost
exactly.
Like we're doing the same thing at work. You're at work, no one would maybe know that you're actually doing completely fine. But it's your family who wears it when you come home and you've got nothing left.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I think what's interesting at work is it's hard then for our colleagues or our bosses to spot that we are struggling because we feel if we ask for help, it won't look good. People will think we're not up to the job. But then exactly, you're right, in our personal lives, there's an incredible price that's being paid. And left to linger for too long, it does put us at risk of clinical burnout.
It's Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor with Dr. Michelle McQuid. We're talking about what a positive work-life relationship can look like. And one of the things Michelle spoke about before was work relationships that involved work that was meaningful. And Jackie, that's really what you've done. You've retired from paid work and you're finding a lot of satisfaction in volunteering.
Well, I have to say my work life was always meaningful, so I can't denigrate that. But when I retired in 2000, I was in local government, and that's very, very satisfying getting things done. But I was asked to be president of the Afghan Australian Development Organisation, and that's been around being founded in 2002, and it's been providing training courses within Afghanistan. And so in August 2021, when the Taliban took over the leadership in Afghanistan, and girls' secondary schools were not opened in March 2022. We got together and put together a program to provide courses for secondary school girls. And we've funded through donations through people in Australia, mostly Melbourne, we've funded 2,000 schoolgirls completing year 12.
Mm, wow. What sort of personal satisfaction do you get out of doing that kind of work, Jackie?
Well, I think it's liaising with, it's a small voluntary committee, liaising with my colleagues. We're all very committed. The satisfaction is knowing that the girls have, some of them have been suicidal. They've been so depressed with their potential, their careers, but you know, they wanted to be doctors or teachers or a whole range of things. They can still go on to teaching. Teaching girls' primary schools on close so they can teach there, and I'm really keen on trying to expand primary education because you can't get to secondary unless you've got primary, and even primary education for girls is a long way to go. But the courses we provide for the secondary girls in Kabul are, you know, it's really rewarding knowing, and the letter getting the response that how much it's helped them. They've been able to then help their siblings, their younger sisters, other relatives, their mothers, more education as well.
And Jackie, it sounds like an incredible amount of work that you're doing there. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Pascal is also called in. You had to make a pretty tough choice recently.
Yeah, hi. Yes, I did. I had a job offer, which was a great new role. It was going to be a fantastic opportunity, but they kind of required people to be in the office 5 days a week, and I couldn't do it. I just thought it would be too much of an impact on my work-life balance, and I'd had a really good routine going with going to the gym and exercising and keeping fit, and so I just decided to stay put where I was, which was only a couple of days in the office. So it turned out to be, I think it was a really wise decision for me.
You're backing yourself in?
That's right. And I'm glad I made that decision. For a while there, I kept thinking, it would have been, great to step up to a new challenge. But in hindsight, I am glad that I did it and stayed where I was.
Pascal, thanks. Thanks so much for calling in. Michelle, we're listening to Pascal there, really making a tricky choice as to whether a high-powered role that probably paid more money, a great opportunity, and retaining the ability to, go to the gym, take care of yourself, take care of your body. How do you weigh those decisions?
Yeah, well, it's different for each of us, Tegan. It'd be awesome if it was just one size fits all and a formula that we could follow. But I love how Pascal there is looking for that work-life harmony of going, I'm more than just my job, right? We were talking before about having that harmony is having other things in our life that we're passionate about beyond just work. I often suggest we think of ourselves as like a big round pie, and how big a slice is work taking up, and what impact is that slice having right now for your sense of well-being and your sense of meaning, and is it a manageable slice? And what we know is that we thrive when we have more than just work as the whole, if work is the whole pie, it's going to be hard to sustain. So I think what we heard Pascal describing was thinking for herself, how big a slice do I want work to take up? And it wasn't being 5 days a week in the office. She obviously had other priorities like being able to go to the gym and ways of life that she wanted to be able to protect, and that's helping her find the work that is going to keep that spark going for her and, again, not leave her drained and exhausted.
Greg has called in. And Greg, you've got a bit of a throwdown. You reckon it's up to us to find meaning in our work, not up to an employer to do it for us?
I think, obviously there's a balance, but we're looking too much on the outside. There's a lot of emphasis on trying to make people feel like their work is meaningful using PR and spin, but ultimately we're responsible for finding the meaning in what we're doing, I think.
How have you done that in your own work, Greg?
I've had a very varied career. I'm a psychologist these days, so an organisational psychologist, so I do very meaningful work at that level, but whatever task I've always done, I've just tried to do it really well, thought about how can I have a positive impact on the people that I'm working with, on my team or my clients, in just small ways. And that brings me joy.
That's great. An organisational psychologist. We're just brimming with expertise on this morning, Greg. Thank you so much. Michelle, what's your take on Greg's perspective there?
Yeah, well, I think meaningful work, organisations have learned, is so important for employees in terms of how we show up and how engaged and energised and productive we are for them. And so providing a sense of purpose in work has become a focus for many organisations. There's also a lot of criticism around what we call why washing. So it's like I'm like greenwashing, but I'm giving you a sense of purpose that we don't always follow through on. And I absolutely agree with Greg. Even if we, as an organisation, are providing our people with a strong sense of purpose in their work, each person still has to find how that resonates with them and what's true for that in them. And I love Greg's question about how can I have a positive impact through my job, and that it doesn't have to be big things. It might just be the person sitting next to me or the person at the other end of the email today that I can maybe make their day a little better or a little easier. Or it might be, as we were hearing earlier from Jackie, that we're doing this incredible work helping a whole country of people be able to access resources. So I think sometimes we think meaning and purpose has to be big for it to count. The research does not support that. Even if you're just making a difference for the person that you're immediately in contact with today, that absolutely adds well-being benefit.
It's an interesting thing you say, because you're talking about the benefit of good people in the office with you, or whatever your work looks like. Someone's texted in saying, this year I was diagnosed with cancer and I've had several months off due to surgery and chemo. Apart from one colleague, I've really not heard from anyone else at work. It's like I've died. It certainly made me reconsider the workplace after 31 years of working there. Like, we can be that person to our colleagues as well as looking for those people around us.
Yeah, we, again, are wired to be social creatures. So these interactions that we have each day as we do our job, whether in person or virtually with people, help to reset our nervous system so that, again, we're feeling more connected, the brain's feeling safe enough, we've got the blood and oxygen up in the front of our head. So I think often we underestimate the impact that we can have on each other and how little it actually takes to send a message or reach out with an email or make a call or stop by somebody's desk as you walk past them and just say, hey, how are you going? How are things today? You know, you want to have a chat, grab a coffee. These are the little moments that make work feel far more meaningful for all of us, but we can get in that task tunnel where it's all about the next thing on that to-do list and we miss seeing each other in the process.
And Michelle, you mentioned before the research you did, you spoke to 1,000 Australians, they told you that they were quietly cracking. And it sounded like you were pretty surprised by the proportion. What is it about now that is making people feel especially strained?
Yeah, well, we asked them what were the causes of quiet cracking because we were curious about what was going on. And we found for about 41% of us, it was cost of living. And I think that's really hard. We're going to work every day. We're putting in our best effort. We're getting results. But we go home and we find it's increasingly difficult to make ends meet. And so that takes some of that joy out of the jobs that we are doing. The second biggest concern was around job security. And I think with all the introduction of AI technologies and the like going on, people are worried about what's going to happen ahead. So some of this is more external, about two-thirds of it's what's happening in the world at large, but a third of it is what's happening at work. The big piece, though, we found for each of us individually was that hiding piece that you were talking about before, Tegan. And so when we're busy hiding this away, we tend to isolate ourselves from the very help and the conversations we'd most need to find a way through the situation. So again, I think things for us to think about: what are our society's work to be doing around cost of living? What are our workplaces work to be doing around job security and giving people some stability? And then what is our individual work to be doing around how do we talk about this with people that we trust rather than hiding that inside?
Kate has called in. Kate, you want to talk about menopause at work?
Yes, I do, Tegan. I just think it's another factor that we could be bringing into these conversations, because when women are, as I did, experiencing that desire to get to have a change or to look for ways to make life a bit better at that time, that menopause can be something that we're overlooking, as I did. I thought I was just burnt out because of my job. But when I then quit my job, and then 12 months later, I found that my mental health had really tanked. Mm. And when I got myself to a doctor, the doctor started talking to me about perimenopause. And that's when I got myself onto HRT with the help of the doctor, and everything improved, you know, within weeks. And that's when I realised that what had been not necessarily an unsustainable work situation was actually that these wider changes in my body were making it harder for me to just do my normal job in the workplace. And I just didn't even realise that that was a factor.
Yeah. And Kate, you're about to go back to work now. How are you feeling about that?
Yes, it's time now to go and look for another job, which is a bit daunting, actually, because once you've been, once you're out of the workforce for 6 months or more, and it's great, but there's also that little bit of, oh, you know, what's it going to be like to go back? So a bit nervous, but a bit excited too.
Okay, I hope today's chats are kind of useful. You're thinking about the sorts of things that you can look for in a role. All the very best to you. Michelle, listening to Kate's story, it just really strikes me that we're whole beings as humans. We're not just our skill set in a workplace. We have bodies, we have outside things going on as well. It all feeds into what we're bringing to work.
Absolutely. And I love Kate's awareness around going, you know what, hormonally, a whole lot of stuff's changing. And that means it's shifting how I see the world, how I feel about the world, what I want from my part in the world. And I think whether this is menopause or it might be other changes that are going on within our bodies, or to your point, Tegan, within our lives as a whole, just sensing those shifts, being open to them, being curious about, okay, what does this mean? And it might mean, as Kate did, hey, we're going to stop working or we're going to change our jobs entirely. Or it might mean, you know what parts of my job can I shift around so that it does feel like there is some more meaning and it's being more manageable for me in the context I now find myself.
Tracy, you've also called in. You're a childcare worker and you made a big change. What did you do?
I qualified 3 years ago to work in the childcare sector. I have three daughters, ranging from 18 to 24. So work-life balance is really important to me to assist them through their busy lives. And as soon as I started working in the childcare sector, I wanted a permanent role, but I could see the stress, the workload for staff was so immense that connecting with the little people that they were there to care for is really compromised. So I made a very quick choice to remain a casual childcare worker so that I don't take on the paperwork, so that I can connect with the little ones in the sandpit and focus on them. And it's made a huge difference to my work-life balance. It's challenging because I'm casual, so there I give up that steady income. But work-life balance is really important to me.
And I imagine there's a lot of meaning that you take from that. You're working directly with the little kids.
Absolutely. I can focus on the joy and the focus on their well-being in those minutes that can become 10, 15 minutes of playtime, which is naturally educational for them. And I see the permanent staff around me very much having to focus on the paperwork that is required, the regulations that are required, which I respect. But if I can go into these childcare centres as a casual and make their load easier by sitting with the little ones and being able to focus on them. So as a casual, it works for me.
Tracy, thanks so much for the call. This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Dr. Michelle McQuid, who's a workplace researcher at the University of Melbourne Centre for Wellbeing Science. She's an author whose latest book is Your Wellbeing Blueprint, Feeling Good and Doing Well at Work. Nick, you've got an acronym that informs your approach to work and life. What is it?
Good morning, Tegan, from Western Victoria. Yeah, I spent 25 years Army, 30 years in small business, and I was asked how did I manage to make those two careers work. And I came up with an acronym for POWER, P-O-W-E-R, You Have the Power.
Power, so, right.
Be passionate about whatever you do. O, open your eyes and ears and listen to what people are really saying. Don't be preoccupied to get your point out. W, know who you are. Tegan, you'll never be Prime Minister of Australia, but you'll make a great radio host.
Thank you. Okay, E?
Enjoy what you're doing. And R, have respect for people, the environment, and most of all, for yourself. Power. I've lived that for 82 years and it's never let me down.
Nick, I love this power, passion, open eyes and ears to listen who you are, enjoy what you're doing, respect. Michelle, are you going to plagiarise that into your next book?
Oh, no, I would definitely accredit that to Nick. I think it's a great acronym and a wonderful way for us to remember again what is in our control. And I think what Tracy was showing us is how in a system or a workplace that might be struggling to help us meet those demands of our jobs with the resources that are provided, where might we make choices around the edges of that to make it work for them and us in her casual choice.
So I'd love to talk to you, Michelle, about how you can make sure your work is right for you. I feel like for a lot of us, there was a day when someone called you up and said, congratulations, you've got the job, and you were over the moon. But then sometimes that spark can fade somewhat. Is it about finding what that was originally, or is there ever a point where you go, actually, no, this is wrong for me, I need to do something different?
Yeah, I think, again, there's a bit of an and in that. The reality is we are wired to keep learning and growing and adapting throughout our lives. So it's rarely ever a set and forget situation when it comes to our work. And I think we've all had that experience, Tegan, as you're describing, where we were so excited to get a role, an opportunity, and maybe even initially while we were in there, we loved it. It was lighting us up. We couldn't wait to get to work each day. And then over time, that can fade away. It's like, is it the job or is it me? So I think we should expect that things are going to shift over time, and we'll have periods where we really enjoy our work and other times where it's feeling more challenging for us. And to keep coming back to these three basics that we started with around, okay, where are the good people around me that I'm connecting with? Maybe I need to prioritise that a little more. What are the good things I'm doing, the what and the how, the tasks of my job, and how am I aligning them to the strengths? So I'm getting more of those ta-da moments we were talking about. And then what is the impact? What is the sense of difference I'm making for somebody somewhere? And again, it could just be the person next to me at the end of the email, or it could be the entire world or something in between.
So what if you do kind of look at all that sort of stuff, you go, okay, yes, fine, I can make the best of where I am, but I actually think I need to break up with my job. What can that look like?
Yeah, so if we're going to break up with our job and we've gone, look, I've exhausted all the avenues where I currently am, it's absolutely time for a change, then the most important piece before we go out looking is to get clear on some of the things that feel most important for us in the type of work that we want. And again, those three things are a good starting place around, well, what kind of people do I want to be working with? What kind of work do I want to be doing and how will it get done? How does that match those strengths? And what kind of meaning, what kind of positive impact do I want to make for it? And that way, as then we're going out, looking at the job ads, putting in our resumes, going through those interviews, it gives us some guide rails for what we're listening for to try to find that right fit for us.
How much is it like the idea of the grass always being greener? Like, is there a reasonable proportion of any job that you can just expect to kind of suck a little bit?
Yeah, I think we need to be realistic that rarely do we go to work and love everything that we do all day. My view, and Gallup research data kind of supports this, is you want to have at least one thing a day where you feel like you're in the zone, you're one with the music, you're in that ta-da kind of flow, is really great for our well-being. It's also great for the work output that we're doing. So I find if I'm not having any of those moments, I've gone sort of a couple of days, a whole week, goodness, you know, a month, a year with no sense of like, yes, I was in the zone there, it felt great, then that's probably that gauge to go, this doesn't feel like the right fit anymore for me. But I think, again, it's hard when we're looking for new roles. The thing I've become most cautious about is who are the people that I'll work with, because I can change a lot of the what and the how and the why. Those things are fairly within my control. But the who, and particularly my boss, I want to have great people that I work with in that regard.
How are you sussing that out? I'm guessing you're not job hunting at the moment, Michelle. Hopefully your boss isn't
listening. Days I work for myself, which might be where I got to with the bosses. But the last job I took was actually, I was working in New York for a company. So I was moving from Australia to New York, which was a big shift as well. And when I interviewed, the boss seemed great, but I asked, could I please interview three of your team members about what it's like to work for you? Because I want to make sure we're a good fit for each other. Ooh. And those conversations were enlightening, and as much for what people don't say as what they do say. But it did give me confidence to make the leap, and I went to New York for that particular boss, and he did turn out to be fabulous.
That is a really, that's a bold move. I really love it. The other thing we were speaking about at the beginning is this sense of just like, it's November. We're all pretty tired by this time of year. It can sort of feel like it's hard to separate the exhaustion of just the reality of living through yet another year, another trip around the sun, and what is happening with your work. What can people do over the holiday, if they're lucky enough to get one, so that they actually do return re-energized, clear-eyed in the new year?
Yeah, so first, let's use this time for rest and recovery and turn off the work notifications, put on the out-of-office message and no peeking. And if you need an accountability buddy for that, then find someone in your family or friends who can help keep you on track. Secondly, during that break, see if you can find one thing a day to do that lights you up. It's going to renew and replenish that energy for what's ahead. So nothing to do with work, something just for the joy of it. Might be as indulgent as taking an afternoon nap or getting a walk outside in nature or catching up with people you feel like you didn't get enough time with this year. And then my last suggestion, which can be a bit controversial, Tegan, but is to try to give yourself a technology break. Even if it's just for a couple of days, you may be amazed what happens if you can turn off your phone largely other than phone calls coming in, but stay off the news sites for a little while, stay off the social media, and just give your nervous system a chance to reset. We're not meant to be taking in this much information and stimulation at the pace that technology now allows us, and our bodies and brains need some rest breaks from that.
It's a heck of a challenge, but I'm game. Michelle, thank you again for joining me today.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Michelle McQuid is a workplace researcher, a senior fellow at Melbourne University's Centre for Wellbeing Science, and an author whose latest book, Your Wellbeing, is Your Wellbeing Blueprint, Feeling Good and Doing Well at Work. And if this is the kind of conversation that you love, you do need to listen to This Working Life on Radio National. Lisa Leong is the host. You've heard her on Life Matters once or twice. This week, they're taking a look at learning at work. And they've also recently released an episode all about understanding the early signs of burnout. Yeah, it's really on the money for what we're talking about today. Find This Working Life with Lisa Leong on ABC Radio National at 11 a.m. on Fridays, or of course, anytime on the ABC Listen app. But don't go there quite yet, because coming up next, it's time to ask Auntie about the case of double trouble with couple friends.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
When your wife becomes best friends with your best friend's wife, all your fun is doubled. But if those best friends become a breaking up friends, then it's double trouble, unless you ask Auntie. Today, we are talking about the complicated relationship dynamics when you and your wife's best friends, who are a couple, decide to uncouple. And to help work out who gets what in this potentially very messy split, we have experts at law, I mean aunties, journalist, author and associate editor at Guardian Australia, Bridie Jabbour. Hi, Bridie.
Good morning.
And Life Matters executive producer Lachlan McIntosh. Lockie.
Good morning, Tegan.
You're on the wrong side of the glass today, friend.
Yeah, this is brave new territory for me.
So, Bridie, how are you guys part of like a couple friendship group? Do you have mates who are also in relationships with each other?
Yes, we have a few, actually, really close friends who are couples. And even one in particular who actually moved to our suburb because of us a few years ago. And we're very close. And then they've had kids since. Our kids are like cousins together. We pick up, you know, from school childcare, regular lunches, group chats, all that kind of thing.
That sounds ideal. Lockie, do you have couple friends?
Yeah, couple friends. I've always strived and wanted the relationships that the sitcom characters and Friends had, you know, like the drop-in situation. And my friendship group has always, you know, since high school through university and then into work, those relationships have sort of evolved. You used to date in your circle and that could be problematic. And then work comes along and you sort of expand that. And then over time, friends have dropped away, relationships have drifted apart. I've seen, you know, a few messy intergroup relationships. It can be good and bad.
I think what you really want is like the ultimate friend group to evolve from that process. But what we have today in our letter writer's drama is that people are exiting the friend group. So anyway, our letter writer is Steve. He describes himself as a usually level-headed bloke losing his shiz. Steve writes, "Since we were three, my best mate Jake and I have been inseparable. As well as doing a long stint travelling and working overseas after school, we also opened a business together. And when both of us had kids, our families tree changed together to the same small town. Because our kids got along so well, our wives ended up being as close as we were. It worked brilliantly. Until last year, when my wife told me she was leaving me. And Jake's wife, Kylie, chose to stay connected to her as a friend." Okay, aunties, I'm just going to pause there. Bridie, what's jumping out at you about Steve's situation?
Oh, the humiliation. I think the being cheated on, it's not just a breakup or a divorce. It's being cheated on, and your wife, and it coming out of the blue, and it not seeming that it's mutual. So there would be, you know, a lot of anger there, which is fair enough, and humiliation.
And in a small town as well, right? Like nowhere to hide.
Yeah, and nowhere to hide. And also that this isn't just a friend. This is more like a brother to me. You know, when you've known each other since you were 3 years old, that's very rare to have a friend for that long. And that's much more intertwined than the usual friendship, even the usual very close friendship, I would say.
So, Lockie, if you're being Steve, our letter writer, how are you feeling about your best friend's wife still being mates with your now ex?
It's a hard thing to control. I think the thing that strikes me with this is all of your major support, like your key major support through this time, the first person you text or call is now really off limits to you. And that is so, it puts me off kilter a little bit because not only is it the best friend, but also who's he going to work in with every day, if they've started a business together,
yes,
like you're on either side of the register or whatever they do, either side of the co-working space, and you're looking at this person going like, are you going home and talking about me with your wife? Like I just feel so hurt on behalf of our letter writer here that the main pillar of his support in his life is now someone who is actually someone he can't talk to.
So the situation is already messy. It could get messier. I think, Bridie, you might have done some foreshadowing here because Steve continues saying, "My ex and I split. I figured Jake and I were such good mates that his wife's, Kylie's, friendship with my ex wouldn't bother me. But then when I found out my ex had actually been having an affair 2 years before we separated and Kylie chose to stay close friends with her even after finding that out, that really stung for me." And Steve says, "And now I keep catching myself having a conversation with Jake in my head, telling him how peed off I am that my ex is still in their lives." So yes, there was cheating going on here. Lockie, you're Steve again. Does this news about the affair, Kylie knowing about it ahead of time, does that change how you see Jake's wife Kylie here?
It does for me, I think, because I'd like to think I'm a pretty principled person, right? So if someone has that information and still decides to side with someone, and let's not forget that at some point everyone was friends. So when you have to choose a side when a relationship breaks up, if you have all the information and one person has wronged another person, I think for me it is pretty clear cut that my support and allegiance is going to the person who is the most hurt, who has done the least wrong. That's sort of where I initially go. And it does mar or put a little shadow over my relationship with this person if they know that someone has hurt someone so profoundly and yet they still want to throw their weight behind them just because, I don't know, they have better chats over drinks or like they do a park run together or something. I don't know. That's sort of where I'm coming from here.
Yeah, Bridie, I feel like Kylie, well, no, it's not for me to say. What would you say about Kylie's relationship to the girl code here?
Well, it's not about the girl code. What's a little bit murky to us is how good friends Kylie and the ex-wife are, because it's not as if it's Steve choosing a side. Steve can't control who his wife is friends with. Like, it's a very messy situation when everyone has been so entwined for so long, because I'm not sure, but I assume it's not just about park runs and drinks. I think that those two women are very good friends in and of themselves. And just on choosing sides, would Kylie see it as choosing sides? Because it sounds like she's continuing her friendship with the ex-wife. But that doesn't mean that Steve is being cut off either.
Lockie's looking very thoughtful over this side.
Well, no, I think I take Bridie's point because, you know, we don't have the full picture of how all of these relationships dynamics work. We know that this person is potentially like losing their best friend and strongest connection in their life, but we have no idea about the wives involved and the best friends they have and how important these relationships are to them or backwards. So it gets a bit murky. I think if we're coming at this from an advice level, the one thing that has not happened is an honest conversation, like actual communication about like, hello, I'm over here a little bit hurt. The way everyone acting is a little bit yucky to me. Could we actually just thrash this out?
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well,
so what jumped out to me was I keep having conversations in my head with Steve and I just want to yell, talk to him,
yes.
Grab him by the shoulders and shake him and say, stop ruminating. You're not going to get anywhere with that. And just talk to him.
Well, there is a part three to this letter. Steve writes, even though Jake's reassured me multiple times I shouldn't ever question where his loyalties lie, last week I was scrolling Insta late at night. Come on, Steve. And a pic popped up of my ex and the guy she cheated on me with, who she's now engaged to, at a party, and behind them were Kylie and Jake. 2 seconds later, the picture disappears, but seeing it felt almost as painful as when my wife told me she was leaving me. I've now started to wonder if maybe Kylie and Jake knew about the affair earlier and never told me. Jake and I meet up most mornings for a run and a coffee, and my instinct is to just stop going, or at least tell him I've seen the picture and I don't see how we can stay friends with my ex still in their lives. But Steve asks, am I cutting off my nose to spite my face? Bridie, you're a big fan of an honest conversation. What do you reckon?
Terrible instinct. I understand the instinct, but terrible instinct to just cut him off. It, you know, that would just keep being even more painful. But I understand the suffering. I think that most of us would know someone who's been cheated on or been cheated on ourselves. And I understand the mindset he's in. Like, it does send you a little bit crazy and obsessive and paranoid. You know, your trust is just has been completely destroyed in probably the person closest to you. So, of course, you start questioning relationships around you. But you can't, especially in a small town, I don't think you can cut off your best friend, your lifetime best friend, because he was in the background of a photo at a party. And I would also suggest muting and blocking every single account that could throw up a picture of your ex-wife.
Yeah, the social media does not do us any favours. Lockie, how do you even start this conversation with your mate?
Well, I think Bridie has encapsulated things really well. If the information we have is correct, I would like to say that if it turns out that the best friend and the wife knew that there was infidelity, you've already lost your best friend.
Yeah.
By them not coming and telling you that. If it's been going on for years and he was aware and you were not told, that is not your best friend. That is someone who's changed,
true.
And that relationship is actually not what you thought it was. So pop off, queen. Like, you know, small town, sure, but the world's a big place. Find someone else.
But have the conversation. Don't cut him off. Like, you have to ask him directly.
Yes.
That question. You have to ask him that question directly.
Yes.
Steve, you are getting such strident advice from the aunties this morning. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I really hope that you can sort this situation out with your mates. All the very best to you. If you have a question that you would like to ask the aunties, all you have to do is email lifematters@abc.net.au. Chuck Ask Auntie in the subject line. But a big radio round of applause for Guardian Australia, Bridie Jabbour and Life Matters EP, Lachlan McIntosh. That's almost it for Life Matters today, coming to you from Jagera and Turrbal Land. And I will be back with you again on Monday for more Life Matters, talking about whether you're still parenting your adult children. More of us are. How do you feel about it? Do you feel like you've put parts of your life on hold because your kids are still very much in your home and in your life? Plus, dodgy claims around Black Friday and what to watch out for.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.